Butavach. Bezos Hashem, I want to take a time at the end to address questions that came up last time and also feedback that I got throughout the week, which I'm getting the impression that it's hanging unclear in people's minds. So we'll probably leave some time, a chunk of time at the end, to come back to some of those points in Yitzhak Shem. But meanwhile, we'll just dive straight in and go forward. I'm not even going to bother recapping because I did that the entire last week. We're in Chavis Halvavis, Shara B'Tochen, Perek Gimel. In the paragraph that begins, Ve'im Kol Zeh. Toward the end of the paragraph. If anybody had 388, thank you. In the English, it's 388. Yashar Koach. At the end of the paragraph, V'yeshayir. So we're continuing our discussion. The Chavis Halavis is giving us approaches and perspectives on why a tzaddik might suffer. So it's all against the general disclaimer that at the end of the day, it's always a very specific individual cheshbon. But nevertheless, he's giving us these approaches. So we saw a number of profound approaches, and now we're going to see the last point that he has on this. Sometimes it's because he is not properly zealous for Hashem. To demand Hashem's honor, to stand up for Hashem's din from the people of his generation. As we know happened with Eli and his sons. We'll have to explain what was going on there a little bit. But first, let's just finish the point. Do you know how to get the light on?
What?
Do you know how to get the light on?
No, okay. We would have done that.
Okay.
I think it's in the white box.
In the white box? Oh, I'm sorry. Give me a second. Okay.
You're taller. No. The air is on, though. So yeah. It's not like we don't have any electricity. That's the weird thing.
Okay, sorry about that. So he's telling us that sometimes it's because of the fact that, yes, this person is a very righteous person, but there's a lot of unrighteousness going on around him, and this person would be expected to stand up and make a statement, to stand up for Hashem's honor. This was the story with Eli and his sons. Like the Pasuk says, right? The Pasuk we know. Let's give the general background of what happened here. Eli was the Gadol Ador. He was the Sheikh of Klal Yisrael. He was also the Kohen Gadol. What happened back in those days, he was already quite an elderly man. And he put his sons in charge of the Mishkan. In charge of the Mishkan. Now, let's not make the mistake of thinking that his sons were lowlifes. They were great people. In fact, they were from the Gedolei Ador, we might even say. They were from the Gedolei Ador. But, and we're not going to get into all the full story now. But what happened was that they basically had the Mishkan kind of running as they had their servants running the place. And they were more involved in a bird's eye view kind of way. And these servants, it kind of started turning into what you might call like a family business, almost like it became like this was their business, their enterprise, and the servants also started exploiting the people. They would take advantage, they would demand more than what was coming from them, They kept people waiting. It turned into an unpleasant business coming to the Mishkan. You were coming up against a certain haughty administration who made big demands of the people, who didn't treat them respectfully. It started becoming an unpleasant experience to come to the Mishkan. This was a tragedy because the Mishkan is meant to be the heartbeat of Klal Yisrael. And when people started becoming turned off from coming to the Mishkan, so first of all, that's a Chilul Hashem in and of itself. That's number one, right? That Mishkan is supposed to be the place that the Mikdash is, the place that epitomizes the highest standards of Avodas Hashem. And people now think of it kind of like in terms of, if you will, like a mafia. And so that was a Chilul Hashem in and of itself. And also, just the fact that people stopped coming. People didn't want to come. And this itself caused the disconnect because we don't appreciate this now. We don't have the whole thing. But the Mishkan, being at the Mikdash, really was the lifeblood of every individual's private life in terms of his ruchnius, in terms of his relationship with Hashem. People went to the Mishkan. The Malbim says that the Mishkan was mamish like the heart of the Nesra. How does the heart work? The heart sends blood, life-giving blood, to the farthest corners of the body, right? Then what happens? It gets dehydrated there, right? The oxygen gets sucked out of it. So what happens? The cells have to make their way back to the heart. They get infused again with the oxygen, right? With that vitality, and then they get sent back out again. So this was mamish, what was going on when there was a Beis HaMikdash in Klal Yisrael. People had to come on a regular basis, right? Three times a year, at least three times a year. Made your way three times a year to the Mishkan. You went out of there infused with that life blood. Your ruchnius was hydrated. It was rejuvenated, right? You came with a fresh vitality that then carried over until the next regular. Now that really deserves more elaboration. We're not going to do that now. But whatever the case is, so you ask, what do we do today? Today we are a dehydrated Klal Yisrael. We have to appreciate that. This is part of what we're missing when we're talking about having the Mikdash. The experience of life was completely different when you had that full vital ruchnius pulsing in your mundane life that you mamish drew off the Beis HaMikdash, the effect of the Beis HaMikdash. We're missing that now. With all of the ruchnius that we have, and we do have rich, fulfilling ruchnius. But nevertheless, the Gra, the Kuzari, they say that qualitatively, it's like a dead body versus a live body in terms of the real experience of ruchnius. Kuzari says even more than that. He says, forget a dead body. He says a dry bone versus a live body in terms of the experience of ruchnius and the way it mamish turns the whole experience of life into something much more quality and rich. But I'm digressing here. The point is, the Klal Yisrael is losing this. Klal Yisrael is losing this. So to get back to our subject, Eli was older, and he wasn't so on top of his sons. And this is how the Mishkan was rolling along. It was causing Chilul Hashem. And Eli was blamed for not taking his sons to task. Eli was blamed and also severely punished for not taking his sons to task. Whereas he had become, you know, the most prestigious family of the Kehuna, was the Kohen Gadol and the Shoifet, the Gzerim and Hashemayim was, and now his family would lose all of its prestige. It would become more like on the sidelines in terms of the Kehuna, and that their seed would die young, unless they would make extra efforts to counter the Gzerim. Whatever the case is, the Chavos HaBavos is using this as an example of a great man whose personal record was impeccable, but nevertheless, because of the fact that he didn't stand up for Hashem's honor, he didn't insist on it, and didn't stand up for Hashem's standards, he was punished. So this is the last approach. The understanding that this really themselves, Yisharim tells us, Kana'us is a function of Avas Hashem. Now, the word kanos today has all kinds of connotations, and in everybody's minds, there are all kinds of different associations. So we have to understand there is right kanos and there is wrong kanos. Wrong kanos is famous. Everybody knows about it. Everybody reads about it. Everybody likes to harp on it. Right kanos has taken flack because of that. And today people just kind of relegate the whole concept of kanos to something for fanatics, something for weirdos. And that's a problem because kanos is a very, the right kanos is a very fundamental function of Avas Hashem. Question.
Is there an example of the right kind of kanos that we have seen that has been in our generation?
What is the right kind of kanos that we've seen in our generation? Oh, so Pinchas is a good example. It's just not our generation. Right, right. But what is something contemporary? Pinchas is the perfect example. By the way, I want to note that on all the blogs, Pinchas was decried as a Meshugana, right? He was nuts. They were saying that back then, right? So, examples of real kanos, and there are plenty. It's just that it doesn't take the form of stone throwing, right? But it does take the form of speaking up. It does take the form of calling spades spades when they need to be called that. My Rebbe was a kanoi. Rebbe Avigdor Miller was an outspoken kanoi. Because of that, he was quite unpopular with many people. He knew it. He knew it. And he took his line anyways. And it came to many subjects. When it came to calling spades spades, and he knew that he would be turning off people, but he had a very, very clear philosophy that if there will be a handful of people who live up to higher standards as a result of what I say, I prefer to lose more quantity and have more quality. This was a whole developed philosophy, which also would not be appreciated today. It wouldn't be appreciated today when it's all about just, let's just be nice to everybody and get everybody in, right? So, but it's important to realize that it's not just about getting everybody in. We want Klal Yisrael to be able to have at least, there's always going to be a pyramid, right? But you would want to have as many people as at highest standard as possible. We don't want to completely let go of the highest standards in order to have many, 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 many more people at the lowest standard. So if you want just a couple of examples of things that came up along these lines. Okay, I didn't come prepared to speak about this. I knew I was going to touch on it, but let's see if some of the practical examples come to mind. Let's see. I had a debate about somebody with this, where it says in Halacha that there should be a person appointed in every shul to ensure that people don't talk during davening. In fact, the wording of the Shulchan Aruch is that it's an unbearable sin, and the person should be yelled at if a person is talking in the middle of davening in shul. I was talking about this once, and somebody came over to me afterwards and said, in his opinion, it's wrong. He didn't know that it's in the Shulchan Aruch. But, so I'm being done like Avschus. But whatever it is, he said, in his opinion, it's wrong. Because he knows that there are many people who otherwise wouldn't be in shul. And yes, if they can be given the opportunity to come to shul. And yes, they'll sit and they'll schmooze, but they're coming to shul. Isn't that worthwhile? It's a taina. But basically, let's just translate it into different terms. Okay, let's just translate it into different terms. This is basically a declaration saying as follows. Let's take the institution called the Beis Knesses, right, something sacrosanct that has been in Klal Yisrael, well, since we didn't have a Beis HaMikdash at least, right? And say, Rabbi Sai, we've reached a point in history where we have to replace the Beis Knesses with Kiruv centers. Kiruv centers are important. But basically, this suggestion is, let us do away with the concept of the Beit Knesset. It's very nice. We have them for a couple of thousand years, but the time has come to replace the Beit Knesset with Kiruv centers. People who still want to go to a proper Beit Knesset to daven, it's too bad. We have to be bringing people in, and giving them a positive experience of a little bit of davening, not too long, a lot of schmoozing, and chalent with whiskey. So, are we ready to say that? Right? We're ready to say that? That's it? Like, we're done with Bati Knesset because we've dropped so low, and now it all has to just be kibbutz centers? Maybe we could say, you know what? Yes, every neighborhood should have its one place where you have the davening at whatever time is appropriate with the right people involved and setting it up in the right way to make it appealing. But the person who wants a proper place to go daven in the old institution called the Beis Knesset is also entitled to have such an institution. And such institutions do involve a certain approach of, I'm sorry, here there's no talking. It can be done with a smile. It can be done politely, but with firmness and insistence. This is just, if we're using one example, the examples get tougher. The examples do get tougher. But again, before I dive into practical examples, I don't want to do it on one foot. I don't want to do it off the cuff. But this point I am making, the understanding that it's a function of Avas Hashem, doing it right, speaking up for Hashem's honor. There are many rules as to how, this is where it gets confusing. In order to be done right, you have to adhere to a lot of rules. There are many rules involved in getting it right. But when it is done right, it's a function of Avas Hashem. I'll just bring out the point. When I was in yeshiva, so there was talk about Elal, yes, flying on Shabbos, not flying on Shabbos. So I was in Mir. I guess any news team knows if they want to find American yeshiva students, you go to Mir. So I was in Mir. And I was once walking outside the yeshiva, I saw this whole news team, whatever, crew, had set up shop, and they had an American yeshiva bachur was standing there, and they were interviewing him, they were asking him questions. Poor guy thought that he would have the opportunity to actually get across a message. Okay, you know. So I just stood there and watched. And they asked him, well, if Elal were to fly on Shabbos, would you fly with them? He said, no, I wouldn't. So they explained the question, you know, just in case he didn't understand. No, we mean would you fly on other days? We don't mean would you fly on Shabbos. Oh, no, okay. But the fellow said, no, I wouldn't fly with them on other days either. Why not? So he explained. He said, well, the reason that Elal are claiming that they should have, you know, my patronage is because they represent the Jewish state. If they represent the Jewish state, then that involves not flying on Shabbos. Once they fly on Shabbos, they don't represent the Jewish state anymore. They don't represent Judaism for me, and therefore, there's no reason I should fly with them more than anybody else. Makes sense. But I was standing there and like, mamish, like itching. Because I said, that's not what the discussion is about. The discussion is about something else. The question is like this. I have a store. I would like it to be my customer. Now, I hate your father. Once a week, I spit in his face and slap him. I wouldn't expect you to come to my store then. But would you come on other days? That's the question. If I love Hashem, then I hurt when I see him slighted and when I see his honor being dragged in the mud. And therefore, I stand up for it. I don't just sit there and say, well, okay, whatever. You know, you just have to be nice. You do have to, and I'm stressing again, and this will answer most of the questions that I'll be asked afterwards. Yes, there are rules that you have to meet. Yes, you can't just go and do whatever you want. It has to be done in a disciplined, Torah-guided way. And there are strict rules as to how to do this right. And there, as I've answered, many of the questions are going to be asked afterwards. But what about? It's true, okay? But to just sit down and say, I mind my business and let other people live and let live, Not if you really love. It doesn't work that way. Question.
Okay, so you have this shul and they don't want to have talking and they, you know, they want their highest standards, right? So yeah. Isn't that the same as every son's? We want our high standards. Shouldn't that same shul, shouldn't they have afterwards the kiddush where people can schmooze? Like, shouldn't they still have an obligation to those people other than saying, well, the community can set up another shul for them somewhere else where people want to talk and
do Kira, like, doesn't those same people who want to hold the highest standards have an obligation in Kira also?
Okay, so the question is, don't the people who have the highest standards also bear responsibility for catering to those with lower standards? So first of all, let's not connect it to Alien Assange, because that wasn't what was going on there. Oh. With Alien Assange, it wasn't that they wanted to maintain high standards. It was really turning into a situation where irresponsible people were just turning it into personal benefit.
Oh,
okay. It was personal gain. That was a different story. That would be akin to a shul that they say, we want to have a high standard, and therefore we're demanding more and more and more and more membership, and if you don't pay the membership, exorbitant sums, we don't want to let you in. Oh. That would be more akin. But in terms of the question that you're asking, they do. Well, I should even say to an extent. Not everybody and not every setting has to accommodate everything. You have yeshivas, okay? You have yeshivas of varying levels, right? You have yeshiva that's top notch, right? They want the most skilled and most conscientious boys. And then you have yeshivas that their specialty and their skill is helping the weaker boys who are conscientious. And then you have yeshivas whose skill is reaching out to the boys who are not interested, right? These are very clear niches. These are clear niches. Now, halavai, then in the real world, it would be as clear and as idealistic as I'm painting it now. I'm not living on a different planet, but at least let's understand in concept, right? Understand in concept. Now, what happens? I actually knew a guy who was struggling, and he wanted to get into one of those yeshivas that is really geared for the really at-risk guys. I was involved with this fellow. He went to be interviewed in the yeshiva, and they said they're not accepting him. Why? They explained it to me. They said, he's not for us. He can be in a higher standard yeshiva. This is not, he won't benefit from being in our crowd. Will anybody have time to send a yeshiva like that? No, it makes a lot of sense, right? Now, but when it's the other way around, then people do have tinies. If you have a guy who's not on the level, who wants to get into a yeshiva that really is cultivating the top level, and they say, I'm sorry, you know, this is not the standard. Here all of a sudden we say, 1 minute, shouldn't everybody be inviting to be welcoming to everyone? The answer is not necessarily. By saying that, we would basically be saying that, forget about developing the top standard, guys. It's painful, often painful. But again, we're coming back and asking, do we really want to declare that that's it? We do not have a place that can really develop the top standard people? Or do we say that there's a time, there's a place for everything? There's a place for everything. So when it comes to this also, if you want to say that the shul should work around, want to make a kiddush afterwards, etc., could be. Could be, but the understanding that it doesn't necessarily mean that they should be compromising their standards. Now, if you're talking about a small community that has one shul, right, and the crowd that's here is either there or nowhere, definitely within the community they have to work something out. They have to create another minion, etc. But when you're talking about community that is all the different places, we certainly will not say that, no, all the shuls should drop their standards so that everybody will feel comfortable there, you know. I don't feel comfortable coming to a shul where if I show up at 9:45, they're almost finished. Right? I don't feel comfortable in such a place. And therefore, it's wrong that shul start at 8 o'clock. Makes me feel lousy.
It's not dropping. You can maintain your standards, but also accommodate others.
So perhaps realistically, that's what I'm saying. No Chabad, problem with that.
Nobody would speak in the Chabad at 7.
There's no problem with that.
Nothing.
There's no problem with that.
There's so much care of work.
Right. That there's no problem with that. It's just that usually the chevra want to get their afterwards won't be interested in going to that place. They'd rather go to the place that's more catering to the whole situation. But it's true. That is not what we're discussing. But okay, the point is that I'm trying to bring out two points. Okay, and I apologize if I'm stepping on everybody's toes. But basically, the two points that we're trying to bring out are, number one, that with everything going on, that's number two. Number one is the understanding that true, valid kanos, and maybe we will spend time next week doing that, they're giving more practical examples of what it looks like when it's done right, is a function of Avas Hashem. And it's actually considered, like we're seeing here, it's considered a fault in the great person who is completely not attuned to that and just is capable of living in his own Dalet Amis, doesn't care what's going on around. Now, Kanos today does take the form of what you were describing. I want to make that point. Sometimes Kanos will take the form of, we have to go out there and get involved in cute. That can be a very strong form of kanos, right? I can't tolerate what's going on around me, and therefore I want to go out there and draw them in. But it also involves speaking up. I'm stressing that because today it's so undermined and it's so unpopular, and I kind of feel like there's a need to fight for an old dying value. So there's no question. We might even say that the main kanos today are like what you described from Chabad, or Sameach, Eish HaTorah, and all the others who are going out there and trying to draw people in that way. These are people vital because of their Avas Hashem. They have a hard time tolerating what's going on around, right? It's a combination of Avas Hashem and Avas Yisrael, and they want to draw others in. We might say that in today's day and age, that's the main form of kanos, but not to completely do away with the concept of sometimes you have to speak up for Hashem's honor, and when something wrong is going on, to be able to speak up in the right way. That's point number one. Point number two is also vital, the understanding that high standards is something valuable. And the fact that we do have to create standards that can accommodate the needs of our dar does not mean that we should completely let go of the high standards. And on the contrary, it places on us a duty to also work very hard to find the ways of still accommodating and maintaining those highest standards. And if it means some people fit here and some people fit there, that is a part of it. Now, I know what I'm saying now is not so popular, but that's part of why I feel it's so important to say it. So we're coming back to the point. The Chavos HaLamas is telling us this point, that sometimes a tzaddik will suffer because he's missing this. He's great in his own personal life, but his sensitivity to Hashem's honor around him is lacking. You know what? I do want to throw in a specific example that just came to mind right now. And again, maybe we'll come back to this next week. I'll throw this in and then we will come back to other things. Maybe some of you were there. After Malinowitz was nifter, I think it was at the Shiva or the Shloshim. It was Hespedim Motzei Shabbos at the Shiva and Motzei Shabbos by the Shloshim. Gamliel Rabinovich, or Malinowitz, considered a mentor. Many of his big life decisions he consulted with Rav Gamliel Rabinovich. Probably people who are close to him have heard the name. Old Mekubal from Yerushalayim. He came to give a hesped. And this is a man, it's amazing to see him. Small, older Yerushalmi, who's bursting with exuberance. Bursting, he comes in with a bounce. He's much older than me. It comes in with a bounce, with an energy, and with a smile. It's like all over the place. And he came up to give his hesped, and he was talking about Avas Yisrael, mind you. Not Avas Hashem, Avas Yisrael. Okay? And he said, you love your fellow Jew. You see him talking during Kaddish. You love your fellow Jew. You see him talking during Kaddish. You go over to him. Now, don't jump. He's not from our time and culture. This is a man who represents a different time and culture. He says, you go over to me and say, I love you too much to be able to bear the thought of you burning. Don't talk in Kaddish, please. That was how he said, but he said it with such a smile, right? He wasn't saying it with fire and brimstone. He was saying with this big beam, I love you, don't burn, don't talk during Kaddish. That was for me a beautiful example. But again, we'll see if we'll come back to this next week, Bli Nedar. Now, okay, I'll take a moment to pause, deep breath, and question.
That this reason for suffering is on the person or is on the generation?
No. This is, we're saying, on the person. And you know what? Let me put into the following perspective. In a certain sense, each of us is an Olam Mole. Each of us, each Jew, Chazal tell us that Chayev Adam Lema Bishvili Nivralim. Every individual Jew has an obligation to say, the universe was created for me. Now, let's just point out something obvious. Chazal say that you're obligated to say that must mean that it's true. Chazal, I'm not going to tell you that you should believe and say things that aren't true. So every individual Jew has to have a mindset of, the world was created for me. Is that egocentric? Kind of. The world was created for, just you expand it a little bit, my relationship with Hashem. Everything is revolving around that. Now, in a certain sense, okay, I'm just saying that because obviously this has to be developed further. In that sense, events of history were actually geared toward me. Hashem took Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim because he was picturing me individually, specifically, personally, because he wanted to introduce himself to me in this way. When he said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, he was talking very specifically to me. He said, I'm doing this whole process because I want a relationship with you. Now, you're not ready for you to come onto the scene yet. I'm giving the Torah now. But your role will only really be properly worked out in another 3,000 years. So wait, I'm going to do a whole bunch of different things in history to set things in place when you show up. So what do you mean? You're saying the same exact thing about the person who actually went through that point in history. That's right. Hashem has many individual, specific, custom-made plans that he intertwines in his great chachmah. But it's very individual. And what he's actually saying is that the whole business would have been justified just for your placing. The creation of the universe, the whole course of history. If that sounds exaggerated to us, it's because we don't have enough of an appreciation of what a single Jewish neshama is and what that means to Hashem. When you look at the entire universe, it's really small change relative to the value of a single neshama. So, question. So, in this sense, we have to realize, this is how I'm coming back to the question you just raised, that when there are things going on around me, on the one hand, it's its own plan. But on the other hand, it's very much about, where do I find my growth in? Where do I find my growth in? This extends from everything to the irritating person in my life. It's part of Hashem's plan of Bishvili Nivra Olam. This person was put right into my life because I needed to have that irritating person in my life. Two, the suffering person who I know, Bishvili Nivra Olam. How am I supposed to be relating to that? How does that fit into my role in terms of help, in terms of sympathy, in terms of, if there's nothing else I could do, to just be hurting because another Jew is hurting, not to be numb to it. If it was brought to my attention, it is part of my olam. And in this sense also, if there is our problems, there are avaris, if there are slights to Hashem's honor going on around me, so again, the question is, I can't just block that out because that's part of my olam that was designed for me. So at the very least, I should be hurting. I should be hurting. It should hurt me. I feel that love for Hashem and I realize that this is hurting him. It should be hurting me. This is obviously deserves more elaboration, but I'll leave it at that right now. Question.
Every generation needs to have their chatzotzer, right? Different needs in different generations. So I've heard Rabbi Milinowitz, that's our quote, tell me if I'm wrong, that we're living in a Starbucks generation.
In a what?
Starbucks. I want my coffee hot, I want it cold, I want it small, I want it large, with vanilla, with odd vanilla, with caramel. Every person wants it their way. That's why there's so many yeshivas. Everybody's leaving, they're starting their own thing. There's so many yeshivas. This is the generation we live in. So you're saying, of course, you have to have kanaos, but not everybody will respond to that.
True. Not everybody will respond to it. And therefore, that comes back to what I'm saying. I did not lay down, I want to make this very clear. I did not lay down now, how do you do kanaos right? I'm discussing the concept. As far as we're concerned, if we want to come away with it in a practical way, all we'll say is, let's be sensitive to it. Just stop with it. That can be the baseline to start with. Not that, okay, whatever, you know, each person for himself. And we'll just say, as in a very basic way, let's be sensitive to it. What should you do about it? Often nothing. Sometimes something. Sometimes A, sometimes B. Or I should put it more accurately. Sometimes A and sometimes Z. Meaning sometimes it can call for very, very different types of responses. But it's true, not everybody will respond. But that weiter, it's not necessarily about that. It's about, how does it affect me? And as someone who's close to Hashem, so this is what was, as far as we're concerned, if you want to take home a point of kanos that is relevant and that you don't have to work too hard to make sure you're getting it right, it starts with that. Let me hurt. That you're getting right. Where do you go from there? That is complex. And often, when it's too complex, we'll say, Sheval Tasek Adif. Better not to act than to take the wrong step. That requires more elaboration, and I'm probably not qualified to really lay that out in full detail. But Blina, the next week, we'll try to give some more examples. Another question.
So I'm going to practice the last pitch to you. I'm hearing that there is a city having buses on Shabbos. Obviously, there's not very much you can do about it, but we should feel the pain of that the city is running, is talking about running buses on Shabbos.
That's right. That's right. To at least feel that pain. And we might also say, you're sitting at your table, the topic comes up, and it's being discussed. Nobody at the table is going to affect it in any way. But also to make your voice heard in terms of let other people hear also that it should hurt. Not just to have like, oh, it's funny, it's all controversy. Right? So along those lines. Okay. A few questions that were raised last week. One question was, we talked about putting yourself into an environment that will cultivate growth. We talked about how the reality around you very much shapes your way of thinking, right? We always consider normal a fallback option. Right? We want to be great. We want to be very good. But in the worst case, if I'm normal, that's okay. Now here, this becomes very critical because the question is, what is normal, right? And that, it can be a very, very wide range of what normal is. We discussed this last week. And therefore, we discussed the importance of putting yourself into an environment that will, first of all, create in your own mind a higher sense of normal, and that will hold you up to a higher standard. We talked about, therefore, being a part of the right community, the right kehila, the right shul, having the right friends, being in the right yeshiva, etc. And the question was raised, how does this work for a woman who basically her environment is her home? Her environment is her home. She's a wife, she's a mother, those are her careers. And how does she put herself into an environment that's going to hold you up to a higher standard? So I conceded ignorance and consulted with the top authority that I know,
my wife.
My wife. Right? So, and I'll make a few suggestions. So, number one is, you do live in an environment, even if you're living in your own. And I do want to stress the importance of, yes, realizing that the great chashivas of appreciating the woman's home being. And of course, I'm not being mechadish anything to the crowd here, but since it goes so against the whole grain of normal, right, in today's day and age, where real accomplishment is outside, the understanding of the worlds that are being built within the home and the very, very, very great role that the woman is entrusted with by being handed the home. That, okay, I'm not going to elaborate on that now. But so how do you create that in the home? So let's first discuss a few aspects of environment that is in your home. So what are you exposing yourself to? The more in touch you are with the modern world, with the outside, right, secular world, the more you'll be battered even though you know that it's not true, and you know, let's not overrate our ability to hear things and not be affected by them. We are affected by the reality surrounding us. And if you're in a reality where it's all about just indulging yourself, and there's very, very little value based on the godless of what it means to be raising a family and being part of a husband-wife relationship, etc., then it will wear down your own appreciation of the greatness of these things. And certainly, if you are being exposed to cheap talk, talk that's foreign to us, it affects our sense of reality. It affects the sense of reality. This is something that deserves a lot more discussion, but we'll just say in a very brief way now, one of the key yesoides in really being in a place of growth in Aliyah, Tara, is putting yourself into a pure environment, the understanding that our minds are a lot more vulnerable than we think. That is one of the big chachmas of the Jewish approach to real Aliyah. It's not, well, I should have the ability and the intellectual backbone to hear things and not be affected. We take the opposite approach. I recognize that I will be affected. And therefore, I want to make sure that what I'm exposing myself is the things that I want as my own ideals. I want to be putting myself into a pristine environment where the things that I'm hearing are the things that I want, are in the direction I want to be moving in. Don't make the mistake of thinking, I can hear these things and enjoy them, and I know that it's not really for me. So that's number one. That's a bit more in the negative sense. Don't expose yourself to the cheap talk of the outside world or minimize it. Meaning, if there's a necessity, whatever it is, the less you can have of that in your reality, the more pristine and the more Aliyah-oriented your reality will be. You'll have the right circumstances for it. You won't have circumstances that are pulling you down, whether you like it or not. Now, to take that to the next step, who are the people you're communicating with on a regular basis? Friends, relatives? Are these people who share your ideals? Or are these people who are going to be working against your ideals, maybe wearing them down? Are you talking to people who are glorifying, you know, the ego, my rights, and my, you know, and all that? Is that the constant talk? Or is the constant talk about giving, how can I be a better mother? How can I be a better wife? Et cetera, et cetera. Right? If you're talking to people who are growth oriented, and this is what they're interested in, right? They're sharing things that they heard in classes that they've been to. They're sharing their own experience in the mindset of, you know, struggles that they're trying to overcome, such that the reality that you are exposing yourself to is a reality of, this is the talk, this is the raid, right? Growing in my roles that I consider central to my avodas Hashem. And let's realize that too, that the role of parenthood and the role of being in a relationship is very, very much about ourselves. Parenthood has a very fundamental role in Yiddishkeit. Chinuch is, I'm not sure exactly how to say this, but it's not mainly about what I'm making my children into, because you don't control that all that much. You have an effect. You don't control it all that much. We might say that even more, it's about what are you making yourself into. The way Reb Don Segal put it is that the home is the Beis Medrash for Midas. It's the Beis Medrash for personal growth. How does that work with chinuch? You might be surprised that it actually works very, very well with chinuch. Often it seems like midas and chinuch have to be two different tracks, because, you know, with kids, you have to put them in their place, you have to show them who's boss, you have to, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I'm not coming to say that none of that is necessary, but ultimately, when you really get to the depth of it, you see how so much of it is on the contrary. It's about things that will be enhancing your midas. Chinuch, at the end of the day, is, the Rav Dessler put it, it is to be mashpia through the ultimate levels of hatova, of giving. So therefore, there really has to be the umbrella approach. I want to be giving. I don't want to be setting them right. You want to be setting them right, but under that umbrella of by giving, and part of the giving is to be setting that right. Now again, you ask me, okay, so how do you do that? This isn't the chinuch class right now. Right now, I'm just laying out that general approach of the understanding that it's about growth. It's about growth. It's about ideals. So then we come to that point also. You want to be talking to people or along those lines also. I want to be growing in my home. I want to be utilizing the opportunities of parenthood. Well, both in terms of my own growth and also in terms of what I want for my children, people who share a goal of that my primary aspirations for my children are to see their ruchni is developing. This is what I want to see. And you want to be exposing yourself as much as possible to people who are along those lines. We'll take it another step further. And here I'm going to say something with a very significant disclaimer. Reading materials. So, of course, negative reading materials comes up under the first point that we made. But now I'm talking about positive reading materials. But I want to start by undermining what I'm about to say, because it's actually important to do that. You can read biographies about great women. That can be problematic. There's two drawbacks. There are two main drawbacks to reading biographies about great women. One is that the biographies are often imbalanced, objectively speaking. They don't share the struggles, right? They show the successes. If we were to take your life and make a book, you know, this thick about it, and talk about all the things you did right, you will have that same sound as the perfect reps. We'll only talk about the things you did right, okay? People struggle. And often that part is not shared when we're exposed to great people's lives. And therefore, you get the impression that greatness means being a malach. Greatness doesn't mean being a malach. Greatness means being a great human being. Taking the humanness and bringing out as much greatness as you can in it. And that will have faults and flaws and failures. It's part of the picture of human greatness. So that's disclaimer number one, we're talking about reading a biography of a great woman. They're not sharing that with you in most cases. I've actually watched the process of writing about great people and weeding out of the parts that are not going to portray that absolute angelic image. I saw that process. So you have to be aware of that. That's number one. Number two, even in terms of what is accurate, if you're going to read it feeling like I have to be this woman, it's again counterproductive. And it's very, very important to have those warnings in place before you open a biography about a great person. I see that I missed some comments. I'm going to try to get to them. Blee Nether, and some comments on the chat. I'm going to try to get to them, Blee Nether. It's very important to realize now. So there, what then is the benefit? If you're able to approach a biography in a way of, I want to expose myself to the greatness that I'm hearing here in order to be affected, but not with a feeling of matching myself up to what I'm seeing here, like we said, for two reasons. First of all, because you're in a different place and she's in a different place. And second of all, because you're not even seeing the real heart, right? So therefore, not as in, she would have never done this. She probably did it. She probably did it many times, right? And she was able to become very great despite the fact that she did that and even other things. She would have never spoken this way. She did, and then she fixed it up afterwards, right? She moved on from there. But they're not sharing that with you because it's not the image you want to portray. So if you're capable of approaching a biography with that very, with the confidence of, I don't have to be what's being portrayed here, but I want to be exposed to the standards, I want it to influence me, then we'd say it's okay to read such a biography, and it will have a positive influence. I'm sorry?
Sorry, of course, the book that Ted brought to all about the Rebbe Kamenetsky was banned.
What's that?
The Making of the Godall, which was a true story of Yakov Kamenetsky's life, with all the ports and all, was banned.
So I don't know. I don't want to relate to specific cases because the problem with that is that sometimes a book ought to be banned. I don't know what the story was in that case. The fact that we're saying that, meaning we can't jump to either side too fast. Sometimes not everything should be published. What was the case in the particular case that you mentioned? I don't know. So therefore, I want to keep away from specifics. Okay, so that, and that's another point to keep in mind. You can be influenced positively by reading these types of things, but you have to do it with that caution.
Why do they make books showing people struggle? And I mean, wouldn't that be a lot more helpful to people than this whitewashed Siddiqui that you just look at and go, "Wow, I can never."
So it's a fine line. Uh-huh. You know what? I'm gonna stop the recording at this point. We're finished. Anybody who wants to get up and leave, please feel comfortable to do so. Really, I'm gonna continue just for another couple of minutes. I really feel comfortable.